Hello, and welcome into the 20th episode of the Thoughts from the Bench podcast. My name is Luke Jett, and I'm your host, and I'm joined with my co-host, Austin Guthrie, and our special guest. He is a writer for ESPN, and his name is Sadiv Sharma. Sadiv, how you doing?
Doing great, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, and we're just, Sadiv is focused in baseball, so we're going to talk baseball naturally. And starting out, I know me and Austin have talked at length about this, but last night the All-Star game and the whole Wainwright grooving a pitch to Jeter, did you have any reaction to that? I know Austin and I have our thoughts, but I wanted to hear your thoughts.
For me, it was less about him actually doing it, but admitting it was the issue I had with it. I mean, I think that it happens a lot. You know, Brett Favre and Michael Strahan, that happened in football. Chan Ho Park did it with Cal Ripken, whatever that was, 10 years ago or so. It just looks bad when you say it, and there's a better way to say it. I think Grant Brisby, it's SB Nation, wrote a good column basically saying it was just a the way he worded it, you know, saying he grooved it in there for him. I think someone said something to the effect of, "I gave him," or you know, well, "there's nothing wrong with giving a guy a fastball," or something to that effect, where it makes it sound less like you're handing the guy the hit when you're actually just, you know, giving him something to hit, and he's taking advantage of that. You know, I think there's it's a minor difference, but it's something that makes it's less insulting. And that's I wasn't gonna freak out about it. I think Wainwright, you know, it's easy as I know, Luke, you're a Cubs fan, so it's easy to jump on Wainwright as the Cardinals guy and want to insult him and want to take it out on him. But you know, I think he had the right idea. He said something he shouldn't have worded it that way, is the bottom line.
Yeah, and it wouldn't have mattered if Molina was behind the plate anyway. I mean, Luke Roy just sabotaged Wainwright anyway, so I best fans in baseball there for you. But I honestly thought, I mean, it costed the NL the game, not the game, but it could have in an instance. But I mean, even if it's an exhibition, as everybody says, I mean, it still does mean something. It is home field in the World Series, and that might not mean much, but it's still, I agree with you. He shouldn't have said it. I mean, he could do it, that's fine, but when you go out and parade around and say it, that's where it kind of seems a little fishy.
Issue, the All-Star game shouldn't mean something, because you don't, if it meant something, then you'd start Clayton Kershaw and use him for 7 innings and, you know, keep your best lineup out there the entire game. It's not managed like a real game, so it shouldn't have any meaning. It's silly, and it's I mean, I think Bud Selig overreacted to a bad situation. I mean, I don't even know, like, that I think back on that, what was that, 2002? It was
Yeah,
such a
I think so.
Silly thing to react to it like that. Like, you had to make some drastic change to make it mean something. I never understood why they needed to make a change just because the game was going to end in a tie. Like, it didn't make sense to me. It seemed completely unnecessary and overboard for for a one-time thing that likely would never happen again. You know, maybe just expand the rosters, or always keep it in the back of your mind that you need to keep a guy. Keep an arm healthy, or keep an arm out there for if it goes 15, 16 innings, but just got silly.
Yeah, I don't really understand why it means anything either. I mean, Austin and I have talked about that too. It's just it's pointless. It just, I mean, it's an exhibition. It's supposed to have fun, and it just kind of tampers with it when it means something.
Just I'll add my input. It's just I don't understand why, like, I agree with you guys that I don't understand why it has the implications that it does. And that's what makes it so, like, bad what Wainwright did. Sure, like, if this had no meaning to the World Series, then, you know, like, I have no problem with him throwing a batting practice fastball to Derek Jeter. But it does, and if the NL would have lost by one, I actually saw this stat. I don't know. I wish I could give credit for it. The AL now has a 62% chance of winning the World Series this year and we don't even know who's in the World Series. Like, that's how much home field has meant in the past. I think it's maybe you can correct me. I believe it's the last 11 seasons, 9 times the home team has won.
Nice.
So it's, I think that that's crazy.
You know, I mean, I get what you're saying, and I mean, you're right. It should, if the game matters, then you shouldn't be grooving fastballs to anyone. But it's also, I mean, if we come back to the larger point of it shouldn't matter. But I also wonder how much home field advantage does really. I'd like to know what went into that 62%. Is that just like overall whoever's had home field advantage has won 62% of the time, or was
I just know that it was like the AL now has a 62% advantage. I wish that I could give credit, and I saw it on Twitter earlier today, and I thought I favored it, but I couldn't find a bad job. But it just seemed like that's a 12% increase, and then that just to me seems kind of crazy. That just takes in the last, I don't know how many last years of different like World Series winners and who won the All-Star game. So
yeah, it shouldn't. I mean, it seems just as arbitrary as going, you know, year to year or whatever it is. I don't see the point of making the All-Star, how the All-Star game improves, like using the All-Star game improves it as far as who gets home field. I wish they could just go with the team with the best record, but I understand there's travel issues and things like that. I've talked to guys that actually have to deal with that stuff, and they make it seem like it's a bigger deal than, you know, I guess the average fan thinks it is. So I guess I'll accept that it's a bigger hassle than we realize it is. Although all other sports manage to do it, whatever. I guess it's different. I mean, maybe they have to. Maybe they have to use more. Have to get more hotel rooms and stuff like that. I don't know. I don't even. But I mean, it's. I don't. Really, actually, the more I think about it, I don't get why they can't just use it.
All right. Switching gears a little bit here, we're going to talk about a topic we discussed right before we jumped on with the Houston Astros and their kind of maneuvering of their draft picks. Now, their top pick, Brady Aiken, a high school lefty, had an injury of some sort with his elbow, and the Astros wanted a significant decrease in the slot money they were going to pay him, and he has not accepted it, and they have already used that money that they thought he would sign for less. Like, the, I'm trying to word this correctly, but say Aiken signs for $5 million, $3 million under slot, they're going to use that $3 million for another player, and they already flew that player down to Houston. I didn't know what your take was on that and how that could affect future plans moving forward.
You know, it all depends on how accurate everything that we're reading and seeing is right now. If it's true, it just seems at the worst, the Astros are really trying to screw with Aiken and really screwing over this kid Nix. At the best, they're just, you know, taking advantage of bad rules and trying to sneak in an extra signing with Mac Marshall, who's their 20, I want to say he was their 21st round pick or something like that. But this is a kid. If I remember correctly, Mac Marshall is a Vanderbilt commit and was a solid commit and, you know, would have been a top 3 round pick, but didn't. You know, nobody was willing to take the chance of drafting him that high because you lose that slot money if you don't sign him. But now it sounds like what they're trying to do is lower that $5 million offer down to $3 million. Still get Nix, who was like the 6th or 7th or whatever round draft pick or whatever, wherever Nix was picked, and then also get Marshall. So if they're just trying to maneuver to get more guys, that's shady and it looks bad. And if they're overreacting to an elbow scan that really isn't a clear injury, then it's not. It just makes the Astros look bad. But we're getting mixed messages here. I mean, the Astros are pretty adamant that they're not, you know, they're not doing anything shady here. They're just trying to do what's fair. Casey Close, who rarely ever negotiates through the media, is not happy about this. So that's what kind of tips me off and makes me think that the Astros aren't, you know,
doing what's right here. Casey Close does not talk to the media about negotiations. He does not try and he's not like Boris, who will go out there and take advantage of his pulpit and really use his channels to try and manipulate the situation through the media. Casey Close will just, like we barely heard anything about Clayton Kershaw's extension, until it actually happened.
Yeah.
Casey Close didn't take advantage of that stuff of the media in that situation. There was something related with the Cubs that I'm blanking on that Close was involved in, and now I'm forgetting what it is exactly. But I know he there was something with the Cubs where we realized like, yeah, we're not going to hear anything about this because Casey Close is involved. So it's a bad situation. I lean towards the side of, yeah, the Astros just look bad here. That's the bottom line, right? It can't be good for them with dealing with other agents, dealing with other players. The Players Association isn't going to be happy. And hopefully, in the long run, the one silver lining you can take out of this is maybe it forces them to change the draft in some way.
Yeah. I don't really like the slot cap amount of money. I mean, I understand the process, but I mean, how you can go over slot however much money as long as you spend doesn't really, I mean, I don't really understand that completely. I mean, I understand you can allot your money to certain draft picks, but I don't really get why it's there. Why don't they just have anybody? I mean, just free signing if there's, I mean, if these players like from I was listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast with Buster Olney, and they said like these players from Cuba are coming over and getting $68 million like Abreu, why can't these high school and college kids get that same amount of money type thing?
Yeah, no, it makes sense. It's they've made some international restrictions with free agents, but like you said, Cuban kids, certain if they've been in the league for a certain amount of time. I don't know the exact rules, but yeah, like I'm pretty sure the kid that's that has is putting on a show on the 26th. I think scouts are going to check him out. Bruceny Castillo. I don't believe there's any restrictions on him. He's going to get a big deal. Jose Abreu got a big deal. We're going to see this a lot with the Cuban guys that you don't have to worry about spending restrictions. That I mean, it's a free market. Shouldn't that be how it is? But the thing is, the reason we're not seeing that with the draft and with the international free agents, why it happened is because they're not part of the Players Association. So the Players Association gave some concessions to the owners during the last CBA negotiations. It doesn't affect them. It doesn't affect anybody in the Players Association. So why would they fight for them when it could lead to them losing some of their own rights? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it kind of sucks in one sense, but I get why the Players Association adamantly fight for guys that amateur players that aren't even in the league yet.
And shifting from the Astros, completely shifting gears to the Cubs now and their prospects, as the last two Cubs prospects have been making certain noise. Chris Bryant obviously tearing up Triple-A Iowa, and now Kyle Schwarber making his way all the way to Daytona. Do you think he's on the same track as Chris Bryant, kind of start out in Tennessee next year, maybe make his way to Iowa?
Yeah, I wouldn't be shocked if he's on the fast track. I don't want to compare him to Bryant as far as the player, as far as the hitter, as far as what we're going to see production-wise in the majors. Bryant is a potential MVP winner if everything goes right and if everything happens as I've been told, and I expect he's going to be a superstar. Schwarber is going to be. If things go right, he's going to be a solid left fielder who will just hit the crap out of the ball. He's a bat. There's a reason you're not going to see him playing a lot of catchers because they want him to move quickly. Let him get as many at bats as possible. Let him start to feel more comfortable in left field. I've talked to him about it. He says he feels very comfortable in the outfield. Just let him fly through the system and hit the crap out of the baseball, and eventually, hopefully in 2016, the Cubs expect that'll be a contending team. He'll be ready to come up mid-season, if not earlier, and kind of be that kind of jolt, another added bat to the lineup. Or who knows, maybe he ends up being a trade piece. I don't want to guess on that just yet. But as far as him being a part of the team, I could see it pretty easily. 2016, as long as he keeps hitting like we expect him to. But he's not. Let's. I get what you're saying, and it's a fair comparison as far as you know how the development goes with comparing it to Chris Bryant. But it's. I think some fans will hear that and think, oh, he's going to be just like Chris Bryant. That's unfair because Chris Bryant's a freak of nature, and you know we're starting to see that he's a. You know, some people are ranking him number one, but he's pretty clearly a top five prospect in all of baseball.
And that outfield in 2016 looks pretty good if everybody makes it to the majors with Schwarber, if Bryant moves out there, Almora's coming up, Soler, and then Alcantara if he stays in the outfield or moves, I mean, super utility guy. I mean, that's just a crowded outfield and probably a trade's coming there soon after.
People always want to the shortstop situation. People are asking about that a lot. It's a pretty nice situation that the Cubs have gotten themselves into. They've amassed a ton of high-end bats that they don't need to make a decision. Now, that's the thing that I keep trying to point out. Like, don't worry about what they're going to do. Don't try and. I mean, it's fun to speculate, but don't. I don't think we should make any grand statements like this is what they'll do. They'll move Addison Russell, or they'll move Starlin Castro. They're going to trade Starlin Castro to the Mets. It's all speculation, and there's nothing concrete there just yet. There's something big is likely to happen in the next year. Yeah, because they have the pieces to do something if they find the right move. Yeah, I'm sure they'll pounce, but don't. It's way too early to start speculating about who's on the move and who plays where because I'm not sure they know yet.
Yeah. And I got one more question about the Cubs before I switch to Austin and the White Sox here. But I was wondering if you are the Cubs front office and you're Jed and Theo, would you throw money at a Lester or a Scherzer if they get to the market this year? Or would you wait till next season around the trade deadline and make a move for Price?
Scherzer just because I think the money is going to be too crazy, but I could see getting Lester and then Price, or Lester and then Jordan Zimmermann, or Lester and then you know who knows. I don't know the exact list, but I think there's at least two other nice arms coming out after next season. And I'm just
Masterson.
focusing on Lester because he kind of makes the most sense to, in my opinion, as far as a veteran guy front office knows well and has won and kind of that presence that could be kind of stabilizing in the rotation and in the clubhouse. But he'd be the guy that I'd look at as the top arm that they're going to go after in the offseason. You know, you can look at Masterson, Kenta Maeda, those guys I think are going to cost a bit less. But Lester's the guy that I'd focus on. I wouldn't say that they're definitely going to get him, but it's it makes sense and they're going to have a lot of money available. And the window opens in 2016 with that sleeper possibility in 15, and Lester would be a nice add to help that case as far as when the window opens and what they want to do.
All right, I'll move it over to Austin now.
All right, I have three questions for you. I'm actually gonna go back to Kyle Schwarber just because I actually saw him on Saturday. He was playing catcher. Do you know? Is this like when he's expected to play more left field? I just call it one game for the Cougars. I don't know if that's where he played the whole times in low A, or when does this transition happen?
He was playing catcher about once or twice a week. As far as I know, it's one of those things that, you know, let him play catcher. And I think in the off season, it makes the most sense to let the, you know, you don't want to draft a guy and say, look, we're moving you off a position. You know, it's not the best way to start a relationship, you know, especially if the guy wants to stay there. You know, these guys are human beings. They have egos. They, you know, he. I'm sure he. I've talked to him. I think he believes he can stick at catcher, but he's also just willing to do whatever the organization says. I think what'll happen in the offseason is he'll kind of get the message that, listen, we believe you can be up on the team by 2016. That's not a realistic timeline if you're a catcher because there's so much work that needs to be done as a catcher that your offense is going to hurt. Like, I mean, look at Wellington Castillo. Wellington Castillo was a bat-first prospect, and his bat has—he's been working so hard on his defense and focusing all his time on his defense that his bat has suffered. And that's not a knock on him or the team or anybody developing him. It has to do with that's just the reality of catchers. Yadier Molina is the same way. You know, I mean, look at his first 5 years in the league. He was perfecting his defense, and it paid off for him. I'm not saying that'll definitely happen with any of these. It doesn't always happen, obviously, because Yadier Molina is a freak. But yeah, no, Schwarber's not going to catch. It's just a kind of a situation where it's like, yeah, you want the player to realize what's best for him before the team has to tell him. That's ideally, you'd like the player to kind of understand, like, yeah, this is what's best for my career.
All right. And second question, how biased am I and Sox fans if we were to say that Jose Abreu is having maybe the best rookie season ever?
I'd have to look at the numbers, but power-wise, yeah, I'd have a hard time disagreeing with that straight power-wise. I think, Pujols had a great rookie year. I'm trying to just think. Ichiro had a great rookie year. Those are the two that stand out. Mike Trout,
yeah. McGuire put up, I believe, 49
homers.
Yeah.
So, yeah, McGuire, I mean, straight power, yeah, you're probably close to it. But, yeah, I mean, now that I remember, obviously Mike Trout would be number one. Then, you know, Pujols, off the top of my head, without looking at lists and just in my lifetime, which started in 1980, so I guess those are two of the guys. I know Fred Lynn had a monster rookie year. I think he won MVP his rookie year. So I'm trying to go off my memory. And I'd say Pujols and Ichiro and Trout are the guys that I'd say, and Fred Lynn. Then there's probably some other guys that, you know, we may not have even heard of because they didn't top their rookie year, or they just kind of fell off the map, or, you know, they're just kind of on the periphery of superstars. But, yeah, Jose Abreu is a freak when it comes to power. He's exceeded my expectations, and his one weakness that I kept hearing about, handling the inside fastball has not been a weakness. So I'm very curious to see what else he has in store.
Yeah, I completely agree with everything you said, and me and Luke have talked about. We also believe that another weakness is that he takes too many strikeouts. Seems like he's just, you know, which of course is going to happen when you hit as many home runs as he has. So he's looking to crush the ball, and he does that a good majority of the time. So it's hard to not that. My third question is something that me and Luke agree upon, and I think he's one of the only people that I've met in Chicago that agree upon this. How do you feel about the Cubs fans hating Sox and Sox fans hating the Cubs?
You know, okay, do you guys both live in Chicago?
Around there.
Around, yeah. Suburbs.
Okay, I grew up in the suburbs, and I grew up mainly a Cubs fan, but I liked the White Sox. I'm a huge Frank Thomas fan. Until I moved to the city, I didn't get the whole situation, truly, because I worked at a pizza place, and people found out I was a Cubs fan, and they treated me like I didn't know anything about baseball, rude. There's this dynamic between Cubs and Sox fans in the city that's really odd, and it can cause a lot of bitterness because Sox fans think, and now I'm just completely generalizing because I know a lot of awesome Sox fans, and I don't consider myself a Cubs fan or a Sox fan anymore, but I'm just going with the stereotypes that I've run into and that I know and that I've heard about. Basically, Sox fans have this chip on their shoulder because the Cubs haven't won anything and they never win anything, but the place is packed and they get all the news, right? Sox fans get crapped on because of the attendance issues about attendance issues, not spending enough money, things like that. So they have this chip on their shoulder. So they look down upon Cubs fans because they look at them like they don't really care about the game. You don't love the game. You're just there to drink and party and everything.
Cues.
So, sorry. Hold on. Let me get a drink. Anyway, so there's that awful dynamic that happens in the city. But I think it would maybe I got the impression that you guys kind of think that whole like dislike between Cubs and Sox fan is silly, and I agree. I kind of like the rivalry. I kind of like the fact that I think you should pick a side, but I don't think you should hate the other side. I think you should be able to appreciate what happened in 2005. It's a little difficult when you have friends that are Sox fans and you're a Cubs fan and they get to rub it in your face. But that's true about any fan base, right? If the Brewers won it all, it'd be tough to listen to Brewers fans talk smack. If the Indians won it all, it'd be tough for you to listen to the Indians fans talk smack. So it's just about any team winning. Winning it all can be tough when it's close, when it's a close by rival in a sense. But yeah, I mean, I understand it. I appreciate it. As a journalist, I don't involve myself in it anymore. But yeah, there was 4 or 5 years ago before I was in the clubhouses, before I was talking to these guys and trying to be a professional, I was not happy with the Sox fans at times because they talked a lot of smack to me and acted like I didn't know anything about baseball. So I was annoyed that I had to prove myself. I'm like, why do I have to prove myself? Why don't you have to prove yourself as a Sox fan? So it's just this automatic assumption that I knew nothing because I rooted for the Cubs.
Do you think there's Sox fans out there? Oh, I know this for a fact, but I think there's more fans that, like, if you're a Cubs fan, you kind of vaguely follow the Cubs, but you really just want the White Sox to win or lose, and that's how, like, it is on, like, there's Sox fans that associate themselves with the Sox, but only care about the Cubs losing.
Yeah, there's that sense that I get. I mean, I hate generalizing, but, I mean, if you want to stereotype them, yeah, you could say there's Sox fans. I think Sox fans in general seem to care more about what's going on with the Cubs than Cubs fans do, and you could argue maybe that's an issue with Cubs fans because Cubs fans aren't, some of them have this, aren't really paying attention to what's going on. You know, they don't care about winning and losing, they care about just having fun at the ballpark. So there's stereotypes on both sides of town that don't make either fan base look great.
Or, in my mom's case, still want Ryan Sandberg to be the manager, and they hate the Ricketts because they didn't hire him. So
yeah,
there's that.
I mean, I've had plenty of issues with Cubs fans that that are on the Ryan Sandberg train. I've been called out and told that I'm a Ryan Sandberg hater, and then I had to take pictures of my basement that's basically a shrine to Ryan Sandberg. I grew up as a huge fan, but I can't allow the fact that he was my idol as a kid influenced my opinions on what makes sense for a baseball team to do in hiring Ryan Sandberg just because he's a Hall of Famer. He has no credentials. That's his credential. Why is he any better than Mike Wadi? What are his credentials that are better than Mike Wadi other than what he did on a baseball field? And why does that matter as far as being a manager? It doesn't. So
I think I got a pretty good bet going. Oh, sorry. I said I think I got a pretty good bet going with my mom that I get $100 if the Cubs win the World Series before the Phillies. So I mean.
Oh, nice! You're fine with that. The Philly system is just awful, and he's not going to be there before when they start winning again. I don't think he's not a very good manager. He's proving that. He's making a lot of mistakes with his. Not that every manager out there is great. You know, Ricky Renteria has his issues when it comes to in-game stuff, but yeah, Sandberg's been making a lot of mistakes of Phillies fans and people out there I've heard aren't too thrilled with what he's doing.
Yeah, the Ryan Howard contract looks fantastic right now. So
yeah, it's
there's that.
Sandberg will probably outlast his GM, but then how much longer, I guess, is the question. How much longer does he outlast Ruben?
We're going to just sign every 35-year-old to a multi-year deal. Is that basically it's going to blow down.
35-year-old. I mean, how do you extend Ryan Howard when 2 years before you need to? And he's a strict first baseman power guy. I mean, that's just an awful, awful decision.
I mean, the Cole Hamels deal it's okay. I don't know how he's pitching this year, but, I mean, decent. But
you know, I'd take that deal as on a flyer. I could see that making sense to some teams. That's a deal I could see the Phillies selling and a team kind of getting him as a steal if he gets back to how he was. But he's not the Cole Hamels that signed that extension. That's for sure. And I don't think that's a mistake on the Phillies' end. It's just the bad luck that comes with pitching. You know, you're taking a risk when you extend a pitcher anytime.
Yeah,
Hamels probably was worth that risk at the time, and just hasn't really paid off.
Yeah. Well, it was great talking to you, Sahadev, and I'll be sure I'm on Saturday. On Saturday, I'm going to the Sox game, so hopefully Abreu hits a couple home runs, and I'll get to see a glimpse of the future Astros 2017 World Series champions.
Exactly right. We'll see some George Springer strikeouts and maybe a home run. But yeah, thanks for having me on, guys. I appreciate it. And anytime in the future, don't hesitate to give me a ring.
All right, thank you
No
very
problem.
much. All right, see ya.